We are talking about the global power elite. We're talking about Zionism and many other related and topics as well that it ties into all of this. And why don't we begin then, Adrian, to talk about the point that we didn't quite get to here in the first hour, at the end of the first hour, in terms of the red lines, the Vatican, and the Nazi connection to Argentina.
Well, yeah, a lot of it has become sort of a mythology, and it's been dramatized. I remember when I was brought up, when I was a kid in New York. I'm 58 right now, so I did all my school in the 60s, the 50s and the 60s, that there were a lot of talk about Adolf Hitler is alive and doing well in Argentina and this and that. And there's been a lot of myths that have found him either in Cordoba in Argentina or in Mendoza, which is on the Andes Mountains, or in Bariloche. I don't think he ever got down here. I think the guy died in the bunker in Berlin. And anyway, if he was still alive, he'd be 122 years old. So there's not much he could do. However, there always has been a link down here. And a lot of it has to do with the Vatican, because as we were saying before in the first segment of the program, the Catholic Church also lost World War II to a great extent. And they had a lot of somersaulting to do. During the first months and even years after the Second World War, the Vatican was instrumental in getting many former Nazis out of Europe through Spain and Portugal to a great extent. And many of them did end up in Brazil, in Paraguay, in Argentina, and elsewhere. Which shouldn't surprise anybody, because a lot of these guys were basically refugees, and a lot of them were very important scientists. Let's not forget that, for example, one Werner von Braun went on to get a pretty good job in NASA running the American space program. I remember there was an old joke that Bob Hope, the American comedian, would say, and when the Russians sent the Sputnik in 1957, the first orbital satellite, and somebody asked him, why did the Russians beat the Americans in the space race? And Bob Hope said, because their Germans are better than our Germans. Which I think pretty much, you know, and it describes things well, because what happened at that time is that Juan Perón, who had just come into power in 1946,
right,
he said, well, if the Americans are taking their share of German scientists and the Soviets are doing the same, I'm going to do something with that too. So Argentina was the first country in South America to have a jet fighter. Why? Because it was basically Hans Ulrich Rudel, Adolf Galland, all the guys who were building them in Germany came to build this in Argentina with the Air Force. We had the first nuclear program. Why? Because the guys who had Hitler's nuclear program came down to Argentina. They were actually taken down. And the channel was the Vatican, no doubt about it.
The one of the most feared Nazis of the SS, Otto Scorsini, he for Christ's sake acted as an advisor to Juan Perón for a while. Even.
He was an advisor to the Argentine Air Force, and he was the guy who saved Mussolini when he had been trapped in 1944, I think it was, on Lake Cuomo. So yes, a lot of these guys made it down here. Most of them just led basically quiet lives, and then they were all picked up. You had the Simon Wiesenthal Nazi hunters picking them up. But there's really more to that, because probably the most renowned and the case was the case of Adolf Eichmann. Now, Adolf Eichmann, many of you have probably heard about it. He was kidnapped by Israeli forces in Argentina in 1960, 11th May of 1960, to be exact. And that is something worth mentioning very quickly, because, first of all, Adolf Eichmann, he was a former SS officer. Actually, he was really with the SD, the Sicherheitsdienst, which is the security service. I'll talk about that in a moment. And he was actually traced by the Israeli Mossad to be living in Greater Buenos Aires. There's a book called The House on Garibaldi Street, because they actually traced him living in a very modest house on Garibaldi Street in one of Buenos Aires' suburbs. So when Argentina was about to celebrate its Independence Day, 25th May of 1960, the Argentine government at the time, led by former President Arturo Frondizi, invited also the Israelis to come over. And they did. They came over with a DC-7 belonging to the Israeli airline El Al. What they did is they kidnapped Adolf Eichmann and they illegally took him out of the country, taking advantage of the fact that this El Al aircraft was sitting on Buenos Aires International Airport, because of the fact that there was an official team that had come here to take part in the Independence Day anniversary celebrations. They took him back to Israel, they tried him, and they hanged him. Now, you might say, well, okay, you know, Mind you, Argentina filed a very strong protest in the UN Security Council, and the UN Security Council said, yes, Israel did commit an illegal act of going against the national sovereignty of Argentina by perpetrating a crime of kidnapping and taking somebody drugged out of the country in Argentina and so on. But let's say that's besides the point. But let's go into why the Israelis were so particularly interested in Adolf Eichmann. They will officially tell you that he was the mastermind behind the final solution at the concentration camps. But it's a bit more than that. You see, Adolf Eichmann was one of the key people at the SD, which was part of the German SS. Actually, he was an Austrian himself, who was negotiating with the World Zionist Congress to bring Jews out of Europe and into Palestine. Because the SS and the Zionist organizations looked at each other and say, hey, we have a common interest. The Nazis want to kick the Jews out of Europe, and the Zionists want to get the Jews out of Europe and into Palestine, and Palestine is in the hands of the British, so let's just dump all these Jews on Britain and see how they can manage that with their mandate in over Palestine, which was the case at the time during World War II. So Mr. Eichmann had apparently a lot of information. He even met with Faival Bolkes from the Haganah, because he was sent to Palestine before the Second World War, 1937 to be exact. He was sent to the British Palestine to negotiate the possibilities. Now, this is 1937, before the Second World War, to see the possibility of mass migrating or emigrating, European Jews into Palestine, even allowing them to go with their money and their valuables. Now, this has been certified, and this is the information that obviously the Jews do not want the world to know about, because the Haganah, which was one of the three terrorist organizations that was quite close to the British authorities, the other two being the Irgun Zwei Leumi, mm-hmm. a terrible terrorist organization run by Menachem Begin, and the other one being the Stern Gang, run by Yitzhak Shamir, who both later became Israeli prime ministers. And they try to say that Eichmann was instrumental in the Wannsee conference, which did take place on 20th January 1942. But again, one of the key issues was, how do we get sizable amounts of Jews to emigrate from Europe and throw them into Palestine? So there was a lot of negotiating and agreements between the international Zionist organizations and the German SS. And that is something that nobody wants to get out into the open. So they figured one of the guys that could really wreak a lot of havoc if he wrote his memoirs would be this gentleman by the name of Adolf Eichmann. Let's pick him up and kill him.
Interesting. So what do you think happened here in terms of some of these, on the surface, then, opposing forces, Adrian? I mean, we have the fostering ambitions from people like Scorsese and others who were in Latin America, Argentina primarily, to kind of set up a Fourth Reich, if you will. That obviously on the surface is totally clashing with the idea that this is going to be Argentina has a lot of a big Jewish community and a lot of Jews there. What happened there? Was there any internal fighting? Did one side win? Did they team up? How do you make what happened there?
Well, definitely one side did win, and that was the British, American, and Jewish side. I think it would be very unfair to say that they came down here to try and found a Fourth Reich, because there was just absolutely no way that could have been done. You need only trace how these guys lived when they were down here, and you could tell that they were all basically government employees because they couldn't get on their own. I've known a lot of them. I was an acquaintance of, for example, Wilfried von Offen, who was the last personal secretary of Joseph Goebbels, and who used to tell me I wasn't even a party member because I resigned from the party when when Germany did the pact, the Molotov-Ribbentrop pact with the former Soviet Union, and Goebbels accepted my being his private secretary without even being a member of the party. He was a member of the armed forces, not the SS, but rather the armed forces. But all of these guys were all basically private individuals doing different things and always being hunted down, because you see, there is one thing that has to be really stressed. Argentina is made up of basically Spanish and Italian stock. And if there is one thing that we don't have, is racism. for the simple reason that we are all just one great big amalgamation of Spaniards, Italians mainly, local aboriginals, because we have a lot of the local people who are here from in America from thousands of years back. Mm. And then we have a sprinkling of just about every other community you can imagine, British, Swedish, French, German, definitely, Turkish, a lot from the Middle East. You have a lot of Muslims here. You have a lot of Jews here. And there are no social problems on account of that. However, the Jewish organizations will always say, oh, there's anti-Semitism here. There's anti-Semitism there. And they will invent it out of nothing, really position it on the media, but it does not exist. And I can even give you a couple of personal examples of that, which show how their exaggerated reactions are, because they need... Actually, Theodor Herzl says this in his book, The Jewish State. They need to keep anti-Semitism going as a way of keeping their own people more or less tied in and more or less united.
Absolutely. It's always, you know, in terms of group psychology and all that as well, it's very beneficial to a group to have an enemy, if you will, as well, even if that enemy is made up, as we can see in so many other examples around the world in terms of how the Western governments is... you know, treating Al-Qaeda, for instance. It's the same basic idea there. But this anti-Semitism card, Adrian, is always, always pulled out, of course. And when we, you know, are trying to make a valid criticism of this political ideology, Zionism, that always comes out. Why is that? And how have they made this kind of successful in a way, Adrian?
Well, let me give you a personal example, which I think goes to show how they can really even take over a country, not just on the political side, but through the media and so forth. I have been writing extensively in Spanish for many years on political issues, international political issues. And one of the things that I wrote very strongly about in 2006 was the invasion of southern Lebanon by the State of Israel. And all the shocking things we saw, the bombing of Beirut, the bombing of Tyre and so forth. I mentioned that even in the public media in very strong terms. I even had a television debate with the man who at that time was the Israeli ambassador in Argentina. And he looked at me at one point and he said, well, are you going to tell me that Hezbollah and Hamas are not terrorist organizations? And I told him, look, any country that is not allowed to have a nation state like Palestine, they armed forces are normally run by the nation state. But if you don't allow them to have a nation state and they are being attacked, they have to defend themselves somehow. So Hamas and Hezbollah are the provisional solution of the Palestinian people to defend themselves against the Israeli invasion. If you want to call them terrorist groups, then you should call the French resistance a terrorist group, because they did not happily accept to have the Germans overrun their country. And I personally admire the French resistance, so I would never call them a terrorist group. And whilst we're on the subject, this Irgun Zwei Leumi, the Haganah, and the Stern Group were three terrorist organizations who used terror extensively to impose upon Palestine and upon the world the State of Israel, and then they merged to become the Israeli Defense Forces. Well, he was very cross at all these things, but what the result of this was that there are two very strong Jewish organizations, Zionist organizations here, I should say, the AMIA and the DAIA. They are initials for the Delegation of Israeli Associations in Argentina. And they included all that I wrote. It's really ludicrous because it's even in English. They included me in their annual report on anti-Semitism in Argentina for the year 2006. Mm. Now, that was translated into English, and it was actually lodged on the official website of the Anti-Defamation League in New York. And for a while, it was even on the State Department of the United States, a website as an example of anti-Semitism. They dedicated something like 12 turded pages to me. So I filed suit. And I told them, look, what I'm doing here is political analysis. I never say one single word against the Jewish community. I wouldn't even allow myself to do that. I merely state that there is a foreign power called the State of Israel whose foreign policy is genocidal, and we're giving examples of that. Mm. So we filed suit, and what we basically did is we asked the judge, look, we just want to ask you one question. Can you please define for us what is anti-Semitism? And I wrote a long essay, which I think I sent you over the email, where I say, here, we will start by contributing to you our investigation of what is anti-Semitism, because anti-Semitism can in no way be the way to define the criticism that anybody can do about the foreign policy of Israel. Just as if you were to now criticize Italy, I wouldn't say, oh, my God, my name is Salvucci. I'm of Italian stock. I feel completely insulted that you are insulting Mr. Berlusconi. So I would have to turn around and say, Berlusconi is an absolute SOB, and there can be no doubt about that. So they pressed the judge so much. So listen to this. The judge finally threw the case out saying there was no wrongdoing on the part of these. Obviously, they couldn't condemn me because I was just merely doing political analysis. Mm-hmm. But they couldn't condemn these Jewish organizations. So they said what the Jewish organizations accused Mr. Salvucci of is of anti-Semitic writings, not that he is an anti-Semite. So I said, wow, that is great jurisprudence. In other words, if somebody writes something on a wall saying, I don't know, death to the Argentinians, you shouldn't put in jail the guy who wrote it. You should put in jail the wall it's written on. Because they were saying that I was accused of having issued writings. So it's the writings that are anti-Semitic, not me.
God.
So, you know, but they have such leverage over judges and over the media that they were able to get to end up getting their way. We were, in a way, completely absolved because there was absolutely nothing that they can say. But it's an example that they will not tolerate any alternative view. Just as when Jimmy Carter, former President Jimmy Carter, wrote a magnificent book called Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid, which is very critical to the state of Israel, they automatically branded Jimmy Carter, of all people, an anti-Semite.
Incredible. And I don't think it's the right time to go into this right now, though, Adrian. I know that you have videos obviously explaining this, but what people have to understand first is what a Semite is before they go and toss around the word anti-Semite, you know? And you have videos and that's an interesting thing. People can look into that themselves. But what I want to ask you a little bit about now is this connection between Freemasonry and Zionism, if you consider them to be linked. I've heard from other people that they do not consider it to be linked. Other people are basically saying that Freemasonry is an extension of, it is Judaism kind of boiled down in a different kind of way, in a different esoteric tradition, if you will. What's your view on that, Adrian?
I would tend to agree with what you just said. It's a boiled down, more wide membership type organization to capture those who are in positions of and who might not normally perhaps agree with Zionist objectives and Zionist interests and would not normally lend their power or their prestige or their leverage to promote Zionism, but who would feel comfortable, even if for rather egotistical business reasons and political reasons, to become a member of a lodge if that will promote their own careers, which is what happens with many politicians and many top businessmen, as a way of becoming part insider, so to speak, without actually having to say openly that they support Zionism, even though they are swimming in a pool of Zionist, or rather I should say, of Jewish Kabbalistic symbolism. In a way, I think that Freemasonry is a rather high echelon, which they need to use less and less to a certain extent, because now they work much more out in the open. They have their think tank network, which are all the major ones aligned to international Zionism. We mentioned them before, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral, the Bilderbergs, the Royal Institute of International Affairs, American Enterprise Institute, the American Society for Argentina or for South America. They operate quite openly. And they don't even need to go into all the hocus pocus of symbolism and so forth, because they do it in very grand political terms. Probably Freemasonry have reinvented or revamped themselves to only accept truly those people they need in the upper echelons. And then they have the lower, I don't know, even the lower, shall we call it social masonry, which would include your Rotary clubs and your Lions clubs, which is just a way of bringing in the local community people, the ones you're really after, trying to align them. But I think that their relative power has waned over the past decades.
Do you think that that's a kind of a cultural invasion? We think about how popular, you know, Oddfellow, the Rotary Club, and all these kind of pseudo-Masonic, if we can call them that, lodges around the world have been set up basically everywhere, but they still hold that little cultural connection to a lot of the Middle Eastern religions and the mythology around that. Obviously, even the whole Bible can be argued to be within that realm as well. But to me, actually, on the surface, that's kind of it's a little bit of an invasion of the mind, wouldn't you say, Adrian? Is that right?
Well, absolutely. And one of the sad things is that if we go back to the Vatican connection, the part of the problem of the Vatican is that they have been infiltrated, this goes back to the 18th and 19th century, by Freemasons. So probably all of their more recent popes, certainly John the 23rd, certainly Paul VI, I don't know about John Paul I, that's why he only lasted 33 days, but definitely in the case of John Paul II and Benedict XVI, there are strong Masonic connections, either in themselves or definitely in the upper clergy, the upper echelons of the clergy. That is their main problem, and they and I know, I had a very, very interesting chat a few months before he died with Irish writer Malachy Martin. He was already quite ill, and he was living in New York City, and he was so gracious to receive me, and we had a long chat, and he said that he had the proof of John Paul the Sixth being Masonic, John 23rd being Masonic, and even and definitely John Paul II being Masonic. And he himself was a Jesuit, so you know I was rather cautious about what he was saying, but he was a punished Jesuit. In other words, they threw him completely out. They just put him aside and they piled him up in New York and said, you know, you just keep your mouth shut. And then he died a few months later. But he was a very good writer who wrote, amongst other books, Windswept House, where he tries to describe all these Masonic influences that went into the Vatican. I say the Vatican because the Catholic Church is a more abstract thing. I want to avoid perhaps people's sensitivities being affected. So, you know, the Catholic Church is religion. I'm talking about the Vatican, which is as good or as bad as the men running it.
That's right. And they can be, these organizations can be infiltrated by different people who are on the surface attributed to, you know, Catholicism, or they might be Jesuits, but then they have different allegiance. This has been going on for thousands of years, these plays back and forth. We know that. But what if we focus a bit on the land of Palestine itself? Obviously here, Adrian, you raised a point in terms of Theodor Herzl and his vision for Argentina that I haven't heard before, but primary focus have seemed to have been put on Palestine for the Zionist movement. So the question is, why this piece of land? Why do the Zionist elite want this? Is it religiously driven? Is political Zionism a religion in a way, and does it tie back to the Bible that this is the promised land? Is it as simple as that, do you think?
There's probably a little bit of each of those things. First of all, I think that it's very important for you, for your listeners to be reminded, because I'm sure that they many of them already know this, that the original, that the Jews basically divide themselves into the Ashkenazim and the Sephardites. It's about 85% Ashkenazim, who are your European, your Polish, your German Jews, or they're coming from that area, and then the Sephardites, the Sephardis, who have truly Semitic blood. They are probably the only Semites within them. Because if you look at Benjamin Netanyahu and you put a black uniform with a double rune, he looks like an SS officer. He's an absolute Aryan. You know, so let's not be foolish and talk about Semitism. When they talk about Semitism, they're going back to the theories of Count Gobineau, who divided between Semites and Aryans based on linguistic factors. And I think, you know, that was 19th century. Mm-hmm. Let's move forward a little bit. So, you know, I mean, who are the Semites today? The Palestinians, the Iraqis, the Afghanis, the Egyptians. So if we're going to talk about anti-Semitism today, yeah, we have anti-Semitism in Iraq, 1.3 million Iraqis dead. We have anti-Semitism of the Aryan Israelites, Israelis attacking the Semitic Palestinians. So definitely, you know, these are things that have to be very, kept very much in mind, especially since the Ashkenazim trace back their origins to the roaming tribe of the Khazars in Central Asia, who converted en masse, all of them at the same time, to Judaism in the year 740. They did that in order to avoid, they were nomads. They were very, very powerful people, but they were just nomads. They did that in order to avoid being either having to go be subservient to Christianity from Constantinople or to Islam from Baghdad. And they said, okay, we don't want to be able to fall under either one of them, and they became Jewish. Now, that in turn went throughout the years. They went into Russia, they went into Poland, and they finally infiltrated into Europe. But they are originally have no Semitic blood whatsoever. They are not even the descendants of the original Jews. So I think that that factor being taken into account, they have taken this Israel, the Hebrew Israel, the biblical Israel, as a rallying point, knowing that they have no rights over that, not even a descendancy rights, and they have generated this entire myth. And probably, I personally believe, it has to do with one of the key issues of their long-term planning. When the time comes for them to usher in world government will have a spiritual capital, and they want that spiritual capital to be in Jerusalem, where they will crown the king of the world, and they're working on that. They, as I say, they have to get rid of two mosques, which are on the the Temple Mount. Mm. But they have to get rid of them and rebuild the Solomon's Temple. It would be the third temple that they would be rebuilding, which according to biblical prophecy would usher in the times when the whole world will belong one way or another to Israel. So I think we have to keep that very much in mind. They do play a lot with psychological factors, and men's psyche needs to have centers, a capital city. They need to see a regal figure. Okay, we don't have a king, but we have a president, and all the trimmings around the president, the White House, all the power, the caravans, they are modern symbols of royalty. They are modern symbols of power, adapted to every country, but they are symbols at all in the end. And let's keep in mind that today's war, and this gives me a lot of optimism, what I'm about to say, today's war, in the end, is not military, it's not political, it's not financial, it is above everything psychological. If Saddam Hussein were still around, he would say the mother of all wars is psy war, psychological war. So if this is psychological warfare, we have to understand it and set up our own counter psychological warfare. And at that, you don't need money, you don't need to have tanks or fighter aircraft, you just need creativity and understanding and alert people. As people become alert to the psychological warfare and they wake up and they start doing their own thing, the power of the global power elite will fall, and it will fall very quickly.
Absolutely. And by the way, I just want to mention the 13th tribe, the 1976 book by Arthur Kessler details the Ashkenazi tribe that you mentioned, the Cathars as well. And another very good source for people, obviously, is Shlomo Sanz, The Invention of the Jewish People. And we got in contact with Shlomo, but unfortunately, he declined to doing an interview with us. I think he's declining doing interviews overall right now because he's probably been very, very criticized, I think, Adrian. And he's just reluctant to talk with anybody in the media, I guess, anymore.
Yeah, it's a shame, but you know, all these are, this is the, rather the hidden side of history, and we have to keep in mind that history, whoever will write your history book, well, as George Orwell used to say, who controls the past controls the present, who controls the present controls the future. So basically, you know, we do have a psychological warfare in just giving us our own version of history. Argentina has gone through these things on a very small scale. The way Perón was ousted, the way he was demonized. First, they tried to get rid of him through violence. That didn't work because the people were still instinctively very much following him. So they said, okay, let's infiltrate him from the left and from the right. And they ideologically all but destroyed Peronism. But I remember there was an old documentary here on the life of Evita Perón, Eva Perón, who was Juan Perón's wife, who died very young. She died at 33. And the theme song would say, I'm going to translate it rather awkwardly into English, If the history that we are giving is the history of those who have won, that means that there has to be another history, the real history, and that is the one you have to hunt for. So we have to understand the worldview of history that we now have is the global power elite's worldview, and all their enemies have been demonized, and all of their friends have been put in the best light possible. And we're even seeing this right now in our daily newspapers. Hosni Mubarak fires at people, and they look the other way and say, well, hey, Hosni, maybe it's time for you to go. The Yemeni president does the same thing. Even Saudi Arabia invades Yemen, Bahrain happens to be where the American Fifth Fleet is. And they all look the other way and say, okay, why? Because Egypt, with Hosni Mubarak, Bahrain, and Saudi Arabia are their guys. Mm-hmm. But if you have one of those who are not their guys, like the Syrian president Assad or Libyan leader Mohammed Gaddafi, they will immediately send in the troops and they will bomb you out of existence. I remember there was an old anecdote from the 40s, where one of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's aides or advisors told the president, Mr. President, we can't support Anastasio Somoza, the dictator of Nicaragua, because he is a son of a bitch. And Franklin Delano Roosevelt snapped back and said, yeah, he might be a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch. So that's
that the fact explains that he won. Yeah.
It explains everything.
Oh, yeah. Crazy. I mean, these are internal matters. If you look at Libya, the latest one, people have compared this to Kosovo, obviously, and similar situations before in the past as well. But these are internal matters. I remember the spokesperson for the Libyan government, he was very, very clear about that. He and they had offered for, you know, external or you know, international inspectors to come into the country to take a look, to sort things out, to open dialogue. No, that's not what happened. NATO sent in the bombing planes. The U.S. were there right away. But to what extent do you feel that, I mean, I personally feel that other countries should never get involved, no matter how bad the situation actually is in one way. These are internal matters that have to be settled by the population within that country. Would you agree, Adrian?
Well, absolutely. And if you look, if you just look at the, every time there is, no matter where in the world, whether it be Canada, America, a European nation, a meeting from, I don't know, the IMF or the World Bank or the World Economic Forum or even the Bilderbergs, and protesters come in and they clash with the police, well, the police aren't very nice with them. The police will throw tear gas every now and then, somebody dies. And you would figure, oh my gosh, should we be invading America because of the way they are repressing these peaceful or not so peaceful demonstrators?
Right,
and the
right.
answer is no. Yeah. It's their own internal thing. If they want to call in the National Guard, well, call in the National Guard and federalize Texas. I don't know. It's not my business. So, you know, they've gotten us used to the fact that all of a sudden somebody decides somewhere, we've got to take Saddam Hussein down. We've got to take Colonel Gaddafi down. And we don't give a damn what the people themselves think. And yet they will hide key pieces of information, such as, for example, that the first country that issued an arrest warrant against one Osama bin Laden was Libya. Because in 1996, to be exact, in November 1996, MI6, the CIA and the CIA's favorite child, Al-Qaeda, were tried to assassinate Muammar Gaddafi because Gaddafi wouldn't allow Osama bin Laden, who was being kicked out of Sudan, to settle in eastern Libya. So what did Osama and Al-Qaeda and MI6 and CIA do? They tried to murder Gaddafi, and they failed. And when the Libyans discovered what it was all about, they issued in March 1998, they issued an arrest warrant against Osama bin Laden. Of course, Osama bin Laden was known then. 5 months later, he bombed allegedly the Tanzanian and Kenyan U.S. embassies. Then he bombed the USS Cole. And then on 11 September 2001, Osama bin Laden hit the headlines big time. But they won't tell you that Libya was the first country that issued an arrest warrant against Osama bin Laden, just as they won't tell you, and you can check this by just going into www.fbi.gov, they won't tell you that if you go into the FBI's official website and you look at the 10 most wanted men, well, you have 9 rapists and killers, etc., but number 5 on the list is one Osama bin Laden, who's just been, they put a little sign saying deceased, and he is wanted for the bombing of the embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, the bombing of the USS Cole, but not one word about 9/11, because
that's
the
right.
FBI admit that they have no proof of any connection between Osama bin Laden and 9/11.
That's right. And obviously Tim Osman, or aka Osama bin Laden, the CIA asset now has been officially has lost his head, obviously. He's been killed. The boogeyman for the last, 15, 20 years, really. But if you look at it, 10 years then after 9/11, obviously. What do you think will happen next in terms of that idea? Will they invent another boogeyman? What's the plan heading here now?
Well, that is what sends a little bit of shivers down my spine, because how convenient that, first of all, we're about to remember the 10th anniversary of 9/11, just in a few months down the road. Obama was having a bit of a popularity crisis, shall we say, because of his birth certificate and all that stuff. Okay, so that came in very handy for him, the fact that he all of a sudden found and killed Osama bin Laden in Pakistan. But the really alarming side is that on 25th of April, just a couple of weeks back, WikiLeaks put out new documentation or filtered new confidential documents whereby Al-Qaeda supposedly announced that if they take down Osama bin Laden, there will be a nuclear hellstorm over America and its interests. Now, they've taken down Osama bin Laden. Are they preparing the excuse to stage a new false flag attack that will dwarf 9/11? I'm thinking in terms of a nuclear artifact, not over a major city, maybe over a minor city. Maybe it'll be over, I don't know, Phoenix, Arizona, but it will, which is expendable and they can even do away with. But it will be so dramatic, it will be so shocking that it will justify a renewed global war against terrorism. And they're going to put in that bag, not just Al-Qaeda, they're going to put in their Syria, they're going to put in their Iran, they're going to put in their Libya, they're going to put all the patriot movements in America, they're going to put in just about anybody they want in Sweden and Argentina and Chile, saying, you are helping the terrorists. You are indirectly responsible for the A-bomb that went off. I don't know wherever they're going to put it off. And that will allow them, or they think it'll allow them, to really intensify this war against terror, which is basically a war against people's freedoms throughout the world.
Absolutely. It's interesting that these some of these things are coming through WikiLeaks as well, of course, because in one sense, then, you could argue that some of these events, Adrian, actually don't have to happen. It can just be showed to, on the surface, be, you know, leaked documents, if you will, in that sense. But that still justifies it now in most people's minds that, oh my God, what lucky we are that they actually thwarted this, or that they managed to stop this in time then. But it still would be like this was in the plan, this was in the work. So they might not have to go to the extent of blowing up a bomb, but they can do it virtually, if you know what I mean, in the minds of people that it almost happened. You know what I mean?
This reminds me of what you're saying, which is so true, to that old book that I think everybody should read, which is called The Report from Iron Mountain, which is a report supposedly prepared at the request of Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara during the Lyndon B. Johnson administration in 1964. And which the report, allegedly prepared by the Hudson Institute, but they never admitted. They always said that it was bogus, that it wasn't really true. But if it's not true, it sounds very, very real. It was allegedly prepared to show that what would happen to America if global peace were declared. And the conclusion of the report is the worst thing that could ever happen to America is for global peace to come about, because we thrive on a war system. They call it that way, a war system, which helps not only to promote the economy through the defense contractors, it also destroys a lot of assets so that we have to rebuild them. And even people, especially males, who are very difficult to incorporate into our society, we can ship them off to war. So it even has a balancing touch on that side. And when it comes to enemies, they said the worst thing, therefore, that could happen to America is to run out of an enemy. And then they start saying, well, what would be possible enemies? And they end up saying an enemy does not have to be real. He has to be perceived to be real. If people will perceive him to be real, then the enemy exists and we can put up, you know, we can continue with this system as happily as we've been doing so far. And that was in the 60s. Can you imagine with the technologies of 2011?
Well, exactly. That's a good point, Adrian. We've discussed that as well with other guests, and the possibility. We can only speculate. We can just see the millions that are counted in terms of ending up in the coffers of the black budgets and so forth. We can just keep an eye on that and just guess the rest of the story, you know what I mean? But I want to get back to this idea then of Zionism. Some of their goals, obviously, the Third Temple that you mentioned before, that's a big symbolic act, obviously. We're talking about world control overall. Also to subjugate people, homogenize people, to make things, from the wonderful diversity they that we have across the world into a one world, monolithic, a mono culture, if you will. What role do you think, multiculturalism has in this plan as well? And if so, can we tie Zionism into that in any way, Adrian?
Well, yeah, because, I mean, figure it. In spite of all the, it's again like whether you're Republican or Democrat, or whether you're Labour or Conservative in Britain, or I don't know, all the whole two, at most three party system. There is a very narrow scope of accepted, tolerated, shall we say, multiplicity. So even from the cultural point of view, they say, okay, we will accept the Muslims as long as they, like the Saudis or the Kuwaitis, for example, will toe the line with us and realize that oil is the energy, the source of energy, and that they will earn millions of dollars, which they will naturally invest in our banks, in JP Morgan Chase. And when they do their shopping, they will go to London and Chicago to do their shopping. Those are good Muslims. Anything else is bad. We will not tolerate Catholics unless they become like the Vatican, tolerating Catholics who will call the Jewish our elder brethren. Then we will tolerate them. So what they are doing is they are merging everything, keeping a very thin varnish or layer of multiplicity. But when you dwell deeper, it's all basically the same thing. It's like saying the same thing in different languages. You know, you just basically say in different languages. That's why they have been harping so much on a borderless world, on culture, on English becoming the key language for every country. Which is okay if you look at it from certain points of view, but when you look at the hidden agenda, it is very, very worrying. And in a way, when you look at globalization, that's what globalization has been about, over the past 21 years. And this spells very bad for the United States, and I'll tell you why. Because just as when they were ready to go from the bipolar world post World War II into globalization, which happened in if you read Zbigniew Brzezinski's book Between Two Ages: The Role of America in the Technotronic Age, it was issued in 1971. It became the seminal book for founding the Trilateral Commission in 1973. You could read between the lines that they were ready to move on to globalization, and that they had to get rid of the Soviet Union. And they did it by infiltrating it economically and culturally. And the Soviet Union just collapsed, and they didn't even fire a shot. So the in came globalization. What has globalization been? Amongst other things, a way of making a standardized cultural viewpoint, a standardized worldview. They have implemented the full, listen to this, because this is very, very, very important, the full electronic infrastructure for control of all society. 800 TV channels, even the internet, if used improperly, mm-hmm. cellular telephones, RFID chips, satellites, etc., etc. Now they have all that. They also deregulated all the economies. They privatized everything. But now they want to move on to the next stage, from globalization, which they are wrapping up, to usher in the coming world government, which will be very authoritarian, very structured. It will have specific centers. It will have global laws where if you break them, you're going to go the same way as Libya went or the same way as Iraq went. So that is what's coming now. And what do they have to do? Just as they needed for the Soviet Union to go 21 years ago, now they need for the United States of America to go, because they cannot risk maintaining a sovereign superpower, which has been in friendly hands, okay, the last 30 years, the Clintons, the Bushes, the Obamas. But what would happen if a real patriot, an American patriot, were to make it to the Oval Office and were to say, I'm not going to have the Federal Reserve anymore, I'm going to bring back a lot of the troops and redeploy them in a different way, and I'm going to just change a lot of things, and anybody that doesn't like it is going to have to meet up with me, and I'm the White House. Wow, that would be a hell of a danger for the coming world government. So they need for America to also go into the waste bin of history. Not that it's going to disappear, but it has to stop existing as it does, the way the Soviet Union stopped existing. Now it's 20 countries, and Eastern Europe are 20 countries, and everything is very different. And the Soviet Union is just an abstract of the past. Well, the United States of America will become something very different, smaller, more controllable, and more alignable, because what we are now having, and it's on the horizon, is a coming world government.
Mm, absolutely. And I mean, as you mentioned as well, in terms of Argentina, Adrian, things are very culturally diverse in that country. And I don't know how the relationship is between these different cultures as well. And I think more and more people in Sweden and other countries as well, in Europe, I think, are beginning to recognize that immigration is a big problem, even people who don't admit this yet in that sense. And this is not because of the fact that we have other people from other cultures just coming in. It's not that. This is having to do with the integration process, which is a total farce, meaning that these different cultures do not get a chance to understand each other. You can't just bunch people in together with each other and not do anything about it, and don't expect them to be, you know, there being clashes, if you will, between the people there as well. I mean, we've had riots here on the streets in Malmö, now more recently in Gothenburg, two of our major cities, and these are driven by unhappy youthful immigrants in most cases as well. And the police are responsible on their end for stirring on these riots further because of their action, which makes all of this obviously at the end looks like a plan to cause chaos on the streets, if you will, which will further cause more police to come out on the street, turning it into a police state more and more. But in any regard, I see integration as being the big problem here. Too many people are coming in too fast, so there is not a chance for these cultures to understand each other. How are things in Argentina in terms of that, Adrian?
But, you know, you just said something which is so, so very true. As I said, I'm 58 and I was brought up in New York. And I remember in the 60s, they had this thing called busing. Since they wanted to force integration of the black and the white community, they would pick up some white kids, and instead of sending them to their school across the street, they would bus them, literally put them on a bus and take them to a black neighborhood and force them into a black neighborhood school. And then they would pick up some kids from the black school neighborhood that had the school right across the street, and they would bus them to a white school, a white neighborhood school. And it didn't work. It was chaotic. Because, you see, the whole rationale behind so-called democracy is that we're all the same, and since we're all the same, we have to get along. Not that we can, we must get along. And that does not work because it goes counter to human nature. Now, I personally am from a Western country, Argentina. I can respect Muslims, and I do, and I can respect Tibetans, and I can respect the Chinese. But to be quite honest, I don't really understand them, which doesn't mean I have to be bad to them, or sure, I will tolerate sure. them being bad with me. Mm-hmm. And they probably have the same problem. Look, I go to Argentina, and I just don't understand you guys, which is okay. Why do you have to bunch people up, as you so aptly said, bunch them up by force? In Argentina, luckily, since we are geographically far away, and we are still basically a country made of Western stock, for example, there is no race problem in Argentina because there are no other races. We don't have a black population. At most, we have the Indian population, which is very small and very localized. So we're very lucky. And I can tell you what I said in the first part. Look, there are no racial tensions in Argentina, but you could turn back and say, sure, because you're all of white stock and you're all basically European, so you don't have that problem. Because if somebody were to bus, I don't know, 2 million Negroes to Argentina, we start having a problem. Or if somebody were to bus 2 million Muslims and they wanted to have and continue doing everything the way they did back in their original lands, we're going to have a lot of trouble. You can't force people to live together. Why don't you just let people sort of find their own thing and something which is being lost completely? Let's start respecting the fact that we are different, and there's nothing wrong with that. Can I give you just a very small example from a political point of view?
Please do.
One of the things that I say when we promote Second Republic is that the financial system has to be subordinated to the economic system. The economic system has to be subordinated to the political system. And the political system has to be subordinated to culture. And I give the following example. In India, the Indian state has to make it illegal for anybody to kill a cow. Why? Because the Hindu religion says that cows are sacred, which is great for the Indians. In Argentina, the political system has to say you can kill cows. Why? Because Argentina's culture is that we eat a lot of barbecue meat, and we have great barbecue meat. Mm. Who's right, who's wrong? We're both right.
Yeah.
If we were right in Argentina for Argentina's tradition in history, and they're right in India, and if you start to blend them together, we're going to have a hell of a big row, because neither is wrong and neither is absolutely right. And we have to respect those differences.
What do you think about the banning of the burqa and I think the niqab as well in France recently, Adrian? Did you hear about that?
Yeah, that's probably a bit excessive because I did. It came out in all the papers and so forth. It's a bit excessive, and I'll tell you why. Because you see, as you start clearing your mind and saying, well, wait a minute, you know, diversity is good, and maybe the whole problem is why are those people in France in the first place? And on top of it, their children are just as French as, I don't know, as Sarkozy. We have to go back to history. After the Second World War, especially, I don't know this so much from the point of view of France, but I do know it from the point of view of Britain because I lived there for 3 years. I lived in London for 3 years. After the Second World War, when Britain got back on its feet and so forth, there were a whole host of menial jobs they just didn't want to do, like pick up the garbage, sweep the streets, and so forth. And they allowed many Kenyans and Nigerians and Pakistanis, the former colonies, to come into Britain to do all those menial tasks. Now, those people stayed in Britain, they had children went to school, and they're as British as Queen Elizabeth. So in a way, you have to ask yourself, well, why do we have so many Muslims throughout Europe? Is it that they invaded Europe, or did France, Britain, Italy invade and colonize North Africa, the Middle East?
Yes.
So you have now a historical perspective where you say, well, hang on a minute, you are the guys that went in there in the first place. You shouldn't have gone in there. So you can't just say, okay, I'm going to kick them all. I'm going to just kick a lot of butts. I'm going to really put them all, arrest them all. And if I don't like somebody's, the fact that they wear, I don't know, something over their head, I'm going to ban it. Because that is too simplistic and it will only make it worse. That's something that, you know, you can sense in America. Every black man or black woman you speak to knows that probably the white guy she or he is speaking to is the great-great-great-great-grandson of another white guy who used to own his great-great-great-great-grandmother or grandfather. And that is a historical cost that has to be handled, and it can only be handled through enlightened education, not by bussing people, not by kicking people's butts, and not by banning their religious styles. You have to find a way out. It's a very complicated problem, but normally, just say, okay, I'm going to ban. It's like saying, I'm going to ban having the flu. You can ban having the flu, but you're still going to sneeze your way through winter.
Well, I think you raise a very important point. I mean, first of all, the Western forces who are involved in getting into these wars, which is the primary motive behind, or you know, why immigration is happening to begin with. So we have a lot of people who are you know, first in a country there where war arrives and they want to get out, obviously, and they might even go to a country where they don't want to be. And at this point, of course, we have, as you mentioned, the kids and the grandkids and the grand-grandkids of those people who have migrated in those countries. And what are they? Are they, you know, if they come from Iraq, are they Iraqi? If they've lived in Sweden for a few generations, are they considered to be Swedish now? So it's difficult at this point, but we cannot blame the ones who are in the country currently. We can't blame, just as you said, Adrian, we can't blame the grandkids for being responsible for something that their grand-grandparents did, right?
Well, yeah, and the best example is something that we were discussing before, Henrik. Why do we have such huge violence in the Middle East? Because the state of Israel is an intruding state of Europeans, founded by Europeans, who have a Western style that has been imposed on a Muslim region. So if you were to get rid of the state of Israel and give Palestine back to the Palestinians, you would solve a lot of problems overnight. A lot of people laughed him down when the Iranian president Mohammed Ahmadinejad said about 3 years ago, he said, look, if Germans, European Germans, the Nazis, persecuted European Jews in Germany and Poland and elsewhere, and you want to give them a homeland, well, why did you have to give them the Palestinians homeland? Why don't you tell Germany, listen, Germany, we're going to take half of Bavaria and we're going to give it over to the Zionist organization, and you're going to fund getting all the Israelis out of Israel and settling like absolute monarchs and princes in Bavaria, and that's the end of that, and we're going to give Palestine back to the Palestinians. We would solve problems overnight. And yet, the fact that there were crimes committed by Europeans against European Jews, who has to pay the cost? The Palestinians, who had nothing to do with this. Now, why doesn't any mainstream media raise that question and say, okay, I'm listening for answers? And you would just have thundering silence.
Yeah, absolutely. Really good point, Adrian. And as well, I want to, did you get a chance to look at the video that I sent to you, Adrian?
Yes, this Swedish lady who wanted to have everything, who's even complaining about anti-Semitism in Sweden. Yes, it's a very short video. I'm not surprised at all.
We will link this up for people so they can take a look at this for themselves. But I think it's interesting from a lot of different points of view. First of all, that this organization called Paideia, it's based in Sweden. It's a Jewish organization. That is basically calling for Europe to become multicultural. Obviously, this is an edited down version of probably a longer video, so we don't get the full story here. I understand that. But at the same time, what is said in the video is being said, and I don't think she's edited in any way the way she is. And I'm curious why overall Europe must become multicultural to survive. I wonder what the plan is for that, and also why this lady, Barbara Spector, is kind of taking it on as a speaker, as a representative for what all Jewish people in the world, and saying that we will be in a leading role behind this of making Europe multicultural. Does any of that make any sense to you, Adrian?
Can I venture a reply to that? It makes a whole lot of sense. You're in Sweden, I'm in Argentina. You're European because you live in Europe. You were educated in Europe, and your whole life is Eurocentric, which is good. I am of European stock, second generation, living in Argentina. So I look at Europe from far away. I've been there, I've lived there, but I'm not actually European. And if anything, I fully, completely, and 1,000% identify with European culture, whether it be ancient Greece or classical Greece, whether it be the Roman Empire or the Roman Republic, whether it be Germania, whether it be France. I don't speak French, and yet I go nuts over France because I think it's one of the most beautiful countries in the world. Even Britain, who are not really European, but, we'll sort of let them in. Naturally, the Scandinavian countries. Europe as a whole is an enormous cultural powerhouse. Everything has come out of Europe. I mean, in the arts, in politics, in philosophy, in science, in technology, and so forth. So that is potentially very dangerous. That's why the supranational world government exercise or experiment is being done in Europe, and it's called the European Union, which will not last because it's a mere experiment and will be merged into the coming world government. So what this lady Proctor, who looks like such a nice, affable grandmother, what she's saying basically is that culture, that strong culture, which has fundamentally anti-Jewish roots, because the European way of thinking and of feeling, especially of feeling things, will naturally reject a lot of the premises of Jewish social behavior. We have to undo that. We have to deconstruct them and then build them up again as global citizens. It doesn't matter if you were born in Sweden. It doesn't matter if you were born in Germany or in France or in Spain. You have to become a global citizen. Why? Because every time that the European psyche has awakened and has realized that the wool has been pulled over its eyes, it has done wonderful things. So the Zionist plot cannot stand and cannot bear the fact that yet again the European psyche might awaken, and today it has technology, because before they were always able to coax you into going to war with each other, the Germans against the French against the English, the Spanish left aside, and so forth. This time Europe has matured, and if the European psyche were to really awaken the way it should, not the way it's being kept artificially dormant, that could be, again, that would be the center of the world, not Jerusalem.
I think a rootless people in regards to then the immigrants, a lot of the Middle Eastern people who are coming to Europe and so forth as well, is more easily controlled. A cultureless people is also more easily controlled, as the culture in many European countries is on the same side, in the same time, then being eroded away. The culture is being slowly, you know, vanished in many countries as well. People are being dug up by the roots, if you will, placed elsewhere. And I think that is the whole agenda behind creating a new human being in a global world, Adrian. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. Look, I'll put a little personal note on that. I am I'm a fanatic, I can't say any other words, of European music. And when I listen, but you have to be in a specific state of mind, and I listen to Bach, and I listen to Mozart, and I listen to Grieg, and I listen to Sibelius, and I listen to Wagner, it doesn't just make you feel good. It changes your psychological structure. It can actually open intuitions that are normally dormant. It will make you see relationships, cosmic relationships that you don't normally see. And you do that with cultural roots, because then you go into a Gothic cathedral and you say, hey, this reminds me of what I felt when I listened to Bach. And then you look at a painting by Michelangelo or Albrecht Dürer or Botticelli, and you say, hey, it's the same thing all over again, because these historical roots are so powerful that they actually open up psychological resources, a veritable powerhouse. So the more I make that dormant, the more I make them rootless, as you very aptly described, the more I bring in people who have nothing to do with those roots, the better I do. I'm a Westerner, so I love Bach. Now, if you make me listen to Indian music or to Iraqi music, I'll say, interesting, but I can't really admit that I feel inspired. And I can understand an Indian saying, not bad, Bach, but it's not my sort of thing. And that's just great, because mankind must have diversity.
Absolutely. And obviously, as it always is, there's always multiple layers on this as well, Adrian. For me, up here in Sweden, we have an ancient culture up here, one that is not encouraged either in school, or it has actually been attributed to racism in terms of, not only the Vikings, but further back, than that as well. So we have in some cases, a 1,000-year-old history, which is, goes back 2,000 years already. But we've been taken over by Catholicism and then the Lutheran Church. And so we already have had waves of invasion and a slow erosion of that culture that we had to begin with up here as well. So it's like we're talking about layers and layers of layers of things that have been built up. And then now even those are being taken away slowly. It's incredible to me.
That's why I think, and I know he wasn't a Swede, he was a German, but that's why I think that the system, even the Zionists, so openly hate Richard Wagner, the German opera composer, because he actually inspired himself on the Viking myths, the Ring of the Nibelungs, with Donner, your Thor, with Wotan, Odin, with all your gods, and that awakens things in people. I'm Italian, I wasn't even born in Europe, and yet I listen to the Ring, and it opens a whole cosmic view. And that is dangerous, because whilst it opens your heart and your mind, it's a feeling. But every great thing done in history starts with a feeling. It starts with a need for something, naught, like the runes, the ancient runes, naught. That's why the sword is called Nautum, because it is in the German opera, because it is based on the need for something. And then when you start to fill in all the blanks with intellectual content. And you say, well, in the 21st century, the way that I would promote and implement this feeling is the following way, with 21st century technology, 21st century ideas, etc. That can become a liberating factor, and that is extremely dangerous for the global power elite. That's where they need to, and use the right word, make us ruthless and just handle us and throw us one way or another, especially through the TV and all the brain destroying and nervous system destroying music or so-called music they have nowadays and so forth. And you know, they are doing a task of destruction.
Absolutely. And I think we should celebrate diversity and keep the different aspects of humanity that is there and encourage that. I mean, but the monoculture again that the New World Order is building up is totally eroding that, and I think that we can see why. And most people you know, might agree or disagree with that, but in a regard, there is change happening on the on the planet, and the only I guess point of argument to argue about is if it's being consciously driven or unconsciously, Adrian. But obviously what we've been talking about here is a very, very conscious plan, if you will, of what is unfolding around us. And I think it's important to highlight it. It's important to talk about it and bring it to people's attention. And then we can argue about if it's what actually is going on, if it's right or wrong, etc. But all we can do is bring attention to it. And I think we've done a good job, Adrian, of doing that here today. And I want to thank you very much for the 2 hours that we've spent together with us. It's been incredibly interesting hearing from you, hearing from your perspective being down in South America as well. And why don't we wrap things up here again by talking a little bit about the websites that you have out there, and if there's anything else you'd like to plug or promote again here, Adrian.
Yeah, very quickly, for those who are, anybody can visit my website, which is asalbucci, asalbucci.com.ar. And then our Second Republic Project, the website is altogether Second Republic Project, as one long word, secondrepublicproject.com. And there you will see the 5 pillars that I mentioned, the personal sovereignty issue, which is so key, and it's basically what we've been discussing in the better part of this program, how to become a founder. We want to sort of found an internet virtual nation so that people, based on a common model that can be adapted to each country, can start doing things in their own countries. In other words, fighting back, because just as globalization was imposed to all of us from top bottom, liberation will come from bottom top. In each house, in each neighborhood, in each block, in each municipality, in each city, in each province, in each country. So that is what we're building there now. It's not rocket science. It's basic common sense. And as a last comment, and although I've been very cautious about making any religious mention, I would just allow myself one small religious comment. The present system that you just described a few seconds ago, if anything, it is absolutely satanic and demonic. It is the forces of destruction working to obliterate the better part of mankind and the better part of what man has created. So it's up to each one of us to know that this is happening, because as they say, the devil's best trick is to make us believe that he doesn't exist.
Well, that's right. I agree, totally agree with that, Adrian. asalbucci.com.ar, secondrepublicproject.com. We will have the links up on redicecreations.com as well for all our listeners. Keep up the great work, Adrian, and thank you very much for your time today. We have really enjoyed it.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
So this is the first program of 4 that we are doing in this series on Zionism and multiculturalism, and we have more shows coming up briefly. And we thought we could make something fun, something different at the end of these 4 shows as well. We're going to give away 4 subscriptions to Red Eyes Creations to the first 4 correct answers to a bumper music quiz that we're doing, beginning with the first clue and the first song here today. We are looking for one word that you can construct from a simple clue in the bumper music. If you think you have the correct answer, send an email with the word we're looking for to redicecreations@gmail.com. And again, the first 4 correct answers will get a 3-month subscription. All right, thank you for listening. We'll be back with more shortly. Keep an eye on the website, redicecreations.com. Let's listen to the first song in our quiz.
We'll be right back. and cleanliness is godliness, and God is empty just like me.